Good morning, Counselor. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Mr. Turbin, I understand you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so with 10 minutes to go in your argument, there'll be a yellow light will start flashing in front of you. And Mr. Wong, you asked for a warning with 5 minutes to go, so the light will come on with 5 minutes to go in your argument. So, Mr. Turbin, if you'd proceed, please.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice Rechtenwall, Justices Akoba, Nakayama, Duffy, and McKenna, and Mr. Wong. I don't believe this is exactly a case of first impression. The Supreme Court did affirm the case of Walz v. Chan, which had the issue of the propriety of a general damages award of zero when amounts were awarded for special damages. But I know that this case, the Conahelli case, does have the additional wrinkle of $1 being awarded in general damages after the jury initially awarded $0 in general damages. And I am certain that the first question that the court would like to ask me, well, does that make any difference? What about that, Mr. Turbin? Does it make a difference when $1, the nominal amount of $1 is awarded instead of $0, and I would propose to you that no, it doesn't make any difference, primarily because the analysis of the ICA in the two cases, Dunbar versus Thompson and Walz v. Chan, point out three reasons why, except in the most unusual circumstances, an award of $0 in general damages is improper. Number one, such an award is inconsistent with an award for special damages. Number two, in such a situation, the jury has clearly circumvented the law and not followed the clear instructions of the court. And three, such an award of $0 when special damages is awarded is against the clear weight of the evidence. Let me discuss those three prongs of the court's legal analysis in Dunbar and Walsh in sequence.
What do you respond to Mr. Wong's argument that there's insufficient evidence in the record on appeal to uphold a pain and suffering or general damages award?
Okay, well, first of all, I would propose to you that 95% to 98% of the record regarding the pain and suffering was before the ICA, and that is the testimony, the videotape testimony and deposition of the surgeon, Dr. Timothy McLaughlin. And I do want to point out at the end of Mr. Wong's brief, he sets out this admonition, this long admonition from the ICA regarding plaintiffs not providing the transcripts. But that had to do with the ICA's ruling on our point of law concerning liability, that the liability award was against the weight of the evidence. That issue we have given up. I mean, we are not, this appeal is only about the general damages. I don't believe that the ICA would have so admonished us if we just went up on the issue of $1 in general damages. I mean, that's my belief. But having said that, the testimony of the young children, Gregory Conahelli Jr. and Tricia Lynn, would have been extremely unhelpful. If I did produce those transcripts, it really would have been a big waste of money that neither my client or myself really wanted to pay. I mean, because the children were very shy, they were extremely embarrassed about the accident, about their injuries, so they had virtually nothing to say about pain and suffering. The one witness that had something to say, and something to say big about pain and suffering, was Dr. McLaughlin. And The ICA did have the advantage of Dr. McLaughlin's record, and I brought it with me, but for example, page 9, lines 15 and 20, Dr. McLaughlin testifies that Gregory Conahelli was very distraught. He was upset, obviously, but he was conscious. He was awake. He was alert to what had transpired, but he was obviously in, I would say, mild to moderate distress. And then he goes on to describe on page 10, lines 2 to 25, he had a very complex laceration of his face, and it was an intraoral laceration, and he had a very bad sore throat, and he had trimus, that's pain associated with the opening of the oral cavity, in other words, the opening of the mouth. And then he goes on to say on page 11, he had a through-and-through laceration, in other words, a puncture wound from the handlebars that went totally through his face, totally through his mucosa, totally through his gums, and even through a portion of his bone, which he later on says caused intense pain. It also went through the muscle, the angularis muscle. Dr. McLaughlin describes that, and through a portion of the teeth. And then he talks about on page 18, lines 7 to 15, all before the ICA, that he had intense pain with palpation of the jaw, touching of the jaw, and trismus, which is opening up the mouth in any way. And then at page 19, he describes in gory detail the surgery he had to do, which was taking, you know, a piece of a flap of skin from his cheek and folding it over the wound and doing it in the right way. I mean, during the operation, yes, he had anesthesia, but he was totally, totally awake. He was totally awake and conscious. And he goes on to say, extremely upset.
Mr. Turbin, but yes. Doesn't the Betancourt case and our other cases say that it's the burden of the appellant to put together a complete record relevant to the issues on appeal? And while in your view this transcript may have been sufficient to establish the basis for a pain and suffering award, how do we know that there isn't something somewhere else in the record that might explain what the jury did in this case in a way that could lead us to conclude that we should have upheld the jury's verdict?
Yeah. Well, Your Honor, I would say it really is a Hobson's choice. The lawyer bringing the appeal, should present the relevant evidence to the ICA, but not the testimony of all the witnesses, not the transcript of the entire trial. I mean, you know, if we take it to its logical conclusion, I mean, you could have a year trial, a two-year trial. Does that mean that lawyers have to produce the entire transcript? I mean, litigation is expensive enough, especially for, you know, poor working people like the Conahellis, if they have to have the obligation of producing, you know, the entire transcript or testimony from witnesses whose testimony is not relevant, then I think there's too much of a burden being put on the working people in our society.
But would they not be entitled to recover the costs of the appeal if they prevail under Rule 39?
Yes, but that doesn't mean, you know, that you have to pay out a large amount of money, and we know how it sometimes goes as far as recovering costs. But we made the judgment that the young children, Trishlin and Gregory Jr. really didn't have much to add at all on the issue of pain and suffering, and Dr. McLaughlin was enough. And likewise the dad.
If you could, Mr. Turbin, I looked at the record and it appeared there actually was quite a bit of motions practice before the trial court about the issue of whether transcripts should be ordered or not. There was a motion by the defendant to compel the ordering of transcripts. There was a point in the record where it appeared that you actually had ordered the transcripts of the child of Gregory Jr., his sister, and his father. Then there was a dispute over whether you should be required to order more. There was a point in the record where it appeared the trial court had ordered you to produce or to order the transcripts, and I was wondering if you could complete that story so I could understand what actually ultimately happened in this case regarding the ordering of transcripts.
Well, when we did bring up the issue of the liability of, you know, the apportionment of liability being against the weight of the evidence, I believe that the defense wanted the transcript of Mr. Hahn, and I thought also the expert, the accident reconstructionist, Clyde Calhoun, and it was quite a bit of money. We didn't believe we needed those transcripts, but it was quite a bit of money to pay for those transcripts. And I think at some point we made the decision that I don't believe that we did not comply with the order of the court as to what we had to order. But it was up to Mr. Wong. Mr. Wong decided what he wanted. He ordered it, and we had to pay for it. We had to pay the court reporter, and we did pay for the court reporter. So I think ultimately, as with regard to the additional transcripts, it was Mr. Wong who decided what was to be ordered. But there's something else on this transcript issue which I want to present here. I believe that under the law, under the Walsh case and the Dunbar case, we did not need to order any transcript except for the transcript of the issuing of the court report, issuing of the jury instructions, what went on with the court after the jury came back with a $0 award, the argument about our motions for a new trial, what we did to try to correct the clearly erroneous award for general damages. We believe that those were the transcripts that was relevant for the appellate courts, and those were the transcripts which we ordered and we supplied to the ICA. I guess the motions practice, it was really the motions practice, the jury instruction discussions on the record after the, both before and after the zero award in general damages was issued. Now the reason why I don't believe testimonial transcripts from the witnesses was necessary is because when I read Dunbar and when I read Walsh and I read cases from other jurisdictions, I see that what the court is saying is that when a special damages award is made, that is sufficient to require an award for general damages and or pain and suffering. In other words, the same evidence that the jury hears on special damages, in this case, the same evidence that the jury heard where a plaintiff requested $12,280 in change in medical bills, that is the crucial evidence. And once the jury hears that evidence and decides that it is mandated that it should award the $12,280 in special damages, which was all the special damages we asked for, all of the medical bills, then that alone requires the award for general damages. I mean, the jury accepted the fact that Gregory Conahelli Jr. had to go to the emergency room, accepted the fact that he had to undergo a 2.5-hour surgery and pay a lot of money in surgery bills. And that fact alone, providing that he was conscious, not dead, meant that the jury had to award general damages. You know, something arguably reasonable and fair in general damages.
Mr. Turbin?
Yes.
In Walsh versus Chan, the case was remanded for a new trial on damages. In Dunbar, the case was remanded for a new trial. In this case, I understand that you moved for a new trial, but on the application, you are requesting a new trial on damages. If we find this verdict to be inconsistent, what relief are you requesting?
Oh, I'm sorry, Justice McKenna,
if we find this verdict to be inconsistent, what relief are you requesting? A new trial on damages only, or would a new trial as to general damages only suffice?
I believe a new trial on general damages only a trial of general damages would suffice, because that was the improper jury verdict. And there was something else I wanted to say on that point. Oh, yes, one other point I wanted to make about the need for transcripts. The issue here is that the jury had made up their mind that they were not going to award anything in general damages or pain and suffering, that they didn't believe in it for whatever reason. And when the trial judge instructed them to go back and reread the jury instructions, they came back with $1. So that, in effect, meant that they were determined, the jury was determined to circumvent the law. They were determined to circumvent the instructions of the trial court. It was a rogue jury. So it's clear that the jury was not willing to pay any regard to any evidence about general damages and pain and suffering. They were just what we call a rogue jury. So for that, in those circumstances, this is one of the reasons why I believe that courts do not require the transcripts of what every witness say during a trial. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the jury heard, what the jury did not hear. We do know, though, that this jury was determined to circumvent the law. And, you know, incidentally, there are quite a few cases. There are quite a few cases around the country where what happened here in the Connehelly case happened elsewhere in Pennsylvania, Oregon, South Carolina, Georgia, where the appellate courts have said you've got to go back and give the plaintiff a new trial on the area of general damages.
If I may interrupt you, Mr. Turbin, I'm concerned about your characterization of the jury as a rogue jury. If that is in fact true, and I guess we've all three of us, Mr. Wong, yourself, and I probably have seen some unusual results over the years, but it seems to me that it would be more fair to send the trial back, I mean, to remand for a trial on all issues rather than on a single issue of general damages, because the jury, in setting the amount of damages, is considering the testimony and liability as well, are they not? You know, how the witnesses testified, whether they were credible, whether they exaggerated, those kind of things. So would you comment on that?
That's a good point. That's a good point, Justice Duffy. And it's, you know, frankly, one I didn't think about. But in that sense, there were a lot of areas in this case I wasn't happy with, including the apportionment of liability. So perhaps it would be the proper thing to do because of the, I don't want to call the jury contumacious, but in a sense it was not complying with the instructions of the court, even when it had a second chance to comply with the instructions of the court. Perhaps that type of desire to circumvent the law indicates that their entire verdict is defective. When I answered Justice McKenna's question, I was just thinking of what's the minimal thing that should be done to correct the situation.
Well, that would have been the best of all worlds for you, correct? You had liability and...
Yes, the best of all worlds would have been...
But you wouldn't be unhappy with sending it back for a completely new trial on all issues.
No, I certainly would not be unhappy about that. And it's true, the other cases, they talk about sending back for most of the cases, the courts ordered new trials. That Pennsylvania case, if I might mention it, Sebasta versus Shihar Corporation at 75 PA period D and C period 4th, 444. That's a 2004 case from Lehigh, Pennsylvania. The Court of Common Pleas ruled that a $1 pain and suffering award was improper where the jury awarded $37,700 for medical expenses and $41,300 for lost wages. In this case, exactly the same thing occurred as in our Conahelli case. The jury first awarded $0 and then was instructed by the court that this was improper, and then the jury returned a verdict for $1 in general damages, and the court ordered a new trial.
Mr. Turbin, just to clarify the record does contain the transcript from Mr. Hahn.
Correct.
Right. And so he describes what happened during the accident, and he in fact describes the injury to the plaintiff.
Correct.
If no one appeals any of the other issues, the only appeal here is from damages, and apparently everyone satisfied that the jury did its job with respect to liability and special damages, taking into consideration judicial economy, et cetera, would you also be, as you originally advocated, supportive of sending the case back only for the question of general damages?
I would be. I know the Supreme Court has the job of preserving of judicial economy and doing what it feels is necessary to correct some injustice, but has to be aware of the burden on the parties and the courts. So, you know, I would certainly accept that, Your Honor. Okay. I'll just mention other cases. You know, there's a 2008 case in Oregon in Mays versus Vajo.
Let me just ask you, was there any dispute about the amount of special damages?
No, there wasn't. You know, my recollection is the jury awarded everything we asked for as far as special damages, just the medical bills. 10-year-old boy, you know, we didn't ask for anything from his days on his paper route or anything like that. No earnings loss, just the medical bills. Mays versus Vajo, 224 OR period, APP period, 426, 198 P3rd, 943. There, the Court of Appeals found a $1 award for general damages was improper when there was over $3,000 in special damages awarded, and there the court ordered a new trial. An older case is McKibben, M-C-K-I-B-B-E-N versus Dunlop, D-U-N-L-A-P, at 185 S point S period C period 459, 194 Southeast 446. And there the Supreme Court of South Carolina ruled that a $1 award in general damages in a serious auto accident case was improper and ordered a new trial. And then one other Georgia case, Travers, T-R-A-V-E-R-S, versus Macon Railway and Light Company at 19 G-A period, A-P-P period 15, 90 Southeast 732. And there, Georgia Court of Appeals stated that a $1 award for general damages was improper and ordered a new trial. And in that case, there were several hundred dollars awarded in special damages.
Mr. Turbin, you're into your rebuttal time. You can continue or you can save what time remains now, whatever
okay,
you prefer.
Unless there's any other questions right now, I would prefer to save my rebuttal time.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the court. What the petitioner is asking this court to do is to overturn a jury verdict, second-guess the trial judge, second-guess the ICA, that the jury got it wrong, they made a mistake. How is the appellate court in a position to make that determination without a complete record on appeal as to that issue?
Mr. Wong, When the jury came back with zero in general damages, you conceded on the record that that was an inconsistent verdict, did you not?
I brought to the attention, Your Honor, that that was an inconsistent verdict under Dunbar and Walsh versus Chandler, yes.
Thank you.
The appellant.
Is there any difference between the jury saying zero, being re-instructed, and then the jury saying, what's the least we can give, or what's the minimum we can give, and then giving $1? Well, is there any significant difference in terms of common sense, fact, or law?
Well, in common sense, there is a difference between zero and $1.
Does it make common sense that, you know, it's any significant difference, any consideration of pain and suffering?
Well, under Dunbar, Dunbar only required a small amount of general damages. Under Walsh versus Chan, it was some amount of general damages. So an award of $1 is certainly consistent at that point in time with the special damages award. So we do see there being a difference, but whether or not there's a difference between zero and $1 for this court to review to determine whether or not it's sufficient or insufficient or consistent with the testimony or inconsistent with the testimony or with the great weight of evidence or against the great weight of evidence requires that this court have the record of all relevant evidence necessary to decide that issue. This is a court of review. It needs.
If I might interrupt you, Mr. Wong, that brings up a very important point for me. Anyway, our law is that general damages are to be reasonable, but they're to be fair and adequate compensation for the injuries. So when I read what the injuries were, and Mr. Turbin repeated them this morning, how can $1 in general damages reasonably be viewed as fair and adequate compensation for these injuries?
Your Honor, first, there is nothing in the record of other testimony which might countermand or weigh against the testimony of the physician with regard to what exactly the injuries were. But the same physician, Your Honor, and Mr. Turbin supplied you references to his deposition transcript, which is not a part of the record on appeal.
Excuse me, counsel. I thought his deposition, the DVD of his testimony, was admitted, and I thought also there was a transcript that was submitted prior to trial that was part of the record, marked up and highlighted with parts designated and parts not designated for inclusion in the record. What was the status of that?
My understanding is that the only thing that was admitted actually into evidence was that DVD. And we had his trial testimony actually transcribed as it was being done during the trial. And for public purposes, that so that when it went up, there would be references to the transcript. But even going to that, the DVD testimony of the doctor that saw him in the emergency room, there was also, after he described the injuries, he also said, yes, he found the laceration of 2 inches at 17:17. He was initially distraught, but he calmed down at 17:16. And these are references to the DVD time notations. The procedure itself was not painful at 17:28. In fact, the plaintiff was awake during it. The doctor saw no nerve damage during the procedure. The procedure started at 11:36 a.m., and he was discharged by 2 p.m. That's at 18:21. He considered the procedure a success at 18:22. He tolerated the procedure well, 18:22. There were no complications, 1822. He expected there would be no problems, also 1822, and he never saw him again at 1825. As such, he couldn't say there was any would be there any residual scarring. That's at 1741 and 42. And he didn't even know if there was any follow-up with the another doctor, 1748.
As I recall, Mr. Wong, his bill was almost $8,000. So forever, is that correct? And that's, you know, I get back to the jury award of the $12,280 and change. In order to make that award, wouldn't the jury have had to find that there was an injury that was caused by the accident, first of all, that medical treatment was reasonably required for that injury or injuries, and that the medical charges were reasonable? All three of those things had to be found by the jury. And it seems like if they did find special damages in that amount, I just don't understand how $1 can be fair and adequate compensation for those injuries.
And Your Honor, in order to make that determination, again, a full record is needed.
Mr. Wong, you could have ordered the transcript, couldn't you have? Once the appellant orders partial transcripts, you're on notice that the full transcripts haven't been ordered. Why should the appellant be obligated to argue to order transcripts that would argue against him? Shouldn't at some point in time you be obligated to then fill in the blanks on what would support your side of the appeal?
Your Honor, the precedent of this court is that the appellant is under the duty to provide the transcripts that are relevant to the issue presented, especially when dealing with an issue of sufficiency of the evidence or consistency of the evidence. That's his issue. That's his burden. It's not my burden to establish the evidence on that issue. He has to establish it.
Well, suppose he has. You're saying, though, that it's not complete, meaning it's not your side of the story? Is that what you're saying?
I can't stand here and testify for what occurred below because there's no record up to the court. I don't think the court wants me to testify as to what the witnesses testified to. But certainly I have my own opinions as to what occurred at the trial level and what the witnesses testified to. And certainly there is a record that needs to be presented for this court to make a determination as to whether or not the evidence is sufficient.
If you had not conceded that the zero general damages award was not inconsistent, then perhaps I could see your argument. But since you conceded that zero was inconsistent, and now you're arguing that $1 is sufficient, aren't we only really dealing with a legal issue as to whether or not $1 can replace zero?
I'm not saying $1 is sufficient or not. I'm saying that the court doesn't have sufficient evidence to make determine whether or not $1 is sufficient under the circumstances because it doesn't have the record of appeal of the complete record to make that determination. It can't put itself in the jury's position to get a complete picture as to what occurred at the trial level. That's the problem. That's the deficiency of the case. At this point in time, is not a Walsh versus Chan and Dunbar case. I mean, it's distinguishable. I think the court realizes that the court did not accept the verdict as in Dunbar and Walsh. It was re-instructed. They re-instructed the jury. The instruction was a good instruction. It did not, as Mr. Turbin has argued in his briefs, impliedly or explicitly require that they come back with a dollar or nominal damages. It was an accurate statement of the law of Walsh and Dunbar, which indicated some general damages. And it did not require that if they could not make a determination of general damages, that they should award $1. It wasn't restrictive in that manner.
Mr. Wong, you agree that in our jurisdiction, a general damages award that is inconsistent with a special damages award can be set aside by the appellate court?
If the award is inconsistent, yes, Your Honor.
Yes, assuming that the award was inconsistent because we may disagree, but if we assume that the difference between $0 and $1 is really no difference, legally speaking, then doesn't the burden shift to you under our case law to show why that general rule is subject to certain exceptions?
Well, it very well may.
And if it shifts to you, have you presented us with evidence of that fits any of the instructions set out in our case law?
Again, we would go back then to the exceptions found in Walsh versus Chan or Dunbar.
Well, one exception is that if the special damages award seems large, sometimes the courts say, well, that was to take care of general damages also. That's not the case here, is it?
That exception may not apply, but there's another exception with regard to because pain and suffering is so personal in nature that the credibility of the party is certainly something that must be evaluated by the appellate court.
So that's the thing about the evidence of pain and suffering is so subjective that the jury could reject any award of general damages based on its assessment of a lack of credibility of the plaintiff.
Correct.
Don't those cases, however, go more toward cases alleging cervical injuries that you don't have any actual physical manifestation of injury?
Well, Your Honor, every injury is different. Certainly, this was an injury where there was at least a laceration. But again, the degree, the extent of general damages is for the jury to decide, and it's within the province of the jury to make that determination. And it's presumed that they acted reasonably and that they followed the law.
But Mr. Wong, under Dunbar, isn't the question whether the jury could have reasonably concluded that the plaintiff suffered no compensable pain and suffering or general damages? And in this case, based on Dr. McLaughlin's testimony, how could the jury have reasonably concluded that there was no pain and suffering?
That, again, goes back to the fact that this court doesn't have, we don't even get to that question because the court doesn't have the full record in order to make an assessment as to whether or not they did reasonably consider.
Mr. Wong, what was the litigation below regarding the transcripts? I assume Mr. Turbin didn't order all the transcripts and gave notice, or you noticed it, and then you asked the court, you moved the court below to order the appellant to order transcripts. Is that correct? Yeah.
What occurred, Your Honor, and it's found in Volume 3, page 326, the plaintiff initially filed their appeal. They raised the issues of liability and damages. They requested on July 25 all the transcripts, every day of testimony. 6 days later, they canceled everything. 1 day after that, on August 1, they then ordered the transcripts of only the plaintiffs. Now, then we ordered transcripts, but then also filed a motion with the lower court saying, wait a minute, you know, it's the plaintiff's burden under Rule 10, the Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure, to provide the court with all relevant transcripts to the issues presented, and the court agreed. The court then ordered that he provide all the transcripts for review, and that order found it in the record.
Mr. Wong, so you're saying that Judge, was it Judge Kim, whatever the, whoever the judge was in circuit court, ordered Mr. Turbin to order all transcripts of
yes,
the
Your
entire
Honor.
Trial?
Yes, Your Honor. To order all the transcripts. He ordered them, and then he was going to pay for the other transcripts that had been ordered so that a complete record went up on appeal.
What about Mr. Turbin saying that you provided the list of the transcripts that were needed?
I provided a list of the transcripts which he did not request. Originally, he requested everything. Then he went back and then he wanted the plaintiffs.
Right.
And then I requested that he pay for the other transcripts that he didn't request other than the transcripts of the three plaintiffs. And their irony is that I requested that he provide the transcript of Dr. McLaughlin to be provided on the issue of damages. I wanted him to present everything. So he was aware of his duty under Rule 10. He was ordered by the court to provide adequate record on appeal. And he said today that it was his judgment at that point in time that he wasn't going to do it. Well, that was his judgment, but that's not in compliance with the rules of the court and the precedent established by this court in numerous occasions with regard to duty of time to provide the record, especially where the issue is sufficiency or a consistency of the evidence presented. So,
why is it just the fact that $12,280 was awarded in specials and $1 in generals? Just the document itself, just the judgment itself on its face, why isn't that inconsistent?
You can't say one way or another without the appellate court putting itself in the position of the jury.
What did Dunbar hold,
though? Held that if special damages were awarded, then there must be at least some award of general damages. So this was some. It certainly might not be $1 is no different, but our position is there is at least on its face a difference between the two. And then it's up for the jury to make that determination, which they did. And the reasons for it, you have to look at the evidence, which unfortunately this court at this point it does not have.
Well, you agree there's objective evidence of pain and suffering based on the special damages. Not subjective, objective evidence.
I would agree that with the special damages, that under Walsh versus Chan, there was needs to be some general damages. As far as...
Would you agree, well, you might not agree, but is it possible that that objective evidence would amount to more than $1?
I don't think this court can say.
Well, we wouldn't be saying one way or the other, would be, because the only question before us is a legal one, whether or not the verdict was inconsistent with the award of special damages. So, in a sense, we don't really need all those transcripts, because we will not be making, if we remand the case, the ultimate determination of what the damages, in terms of general damages, should be, if we limit the remand to that issue.
Well, it's a slippery slope, Your Honor, because if the court is going to
say...
But
maybe it's not that slippery at $1. I mean, if we're talking, $2,000 for generals, but is it that slippery at $1?
Well, I think it's slippery when the presumption is that the jury has acted reasonably and followed the law. I mean, is $10? Is $100? I think once the court makes that position,
do you put any consideration on the fact that the jury came back and said, in light of the instruction to award fair and adequate damages, asking what is the minimum we can give?
Well, Your Honor,
is the minimum we can give have any relationship to fair and adequate compensation for pain and suffering?
They certainly had a question. The response to them was that they should go back and look at the instruction on general damages. There was no objection to that instruction by counsel when it was given. And so, putting the court in the position of shoes of the jury without all that, the record, you cannot say that they did or they did not act reasonably under the circumstances. They didn't look at the evidence. They didn't weigh it. Certainly, they may have looked at it and said, this is what we feel is reasonable under the circumstances of this particular case. And the juries, the panel, we depend upon them to act reasonably and follow the law, and that's what the presumption is. Without a record, how can that presumption be overturned? That is, again, a fatal flaw of the case. And Mr. Turbin said they must have been persuaded by some bias or ill motive, but there's certainly no evidence of that. There's nothing in the record with regard to that. And Mr. Turbin, if he felt that, he never moved to interview the jurors at the end of the trial to make a determination as to whether or not they were so influenced. And certainly, they again presumed to have acted reasonably. So, Your Honor, we feel that the jury acted properly in this case, the lower court, the trial judge acted properly, the ICA decision was a proper one, there's an insufficient record to demonstrate otherwise, and for those reasons. Respectfully,
of course,
that the summary disposition order
will
be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wong. Mr. Turbin, your rebuttal.
Thank you. First, I do want to say that I respectfully take umbrage with Mr. Wong suggesting that I didn't comply with an order from the trial judge, Judge Kim, to pay for the transcripts. We didn't brief this issue. It didn't come up in any of the points of appeal or error, but my clear recollection is that we went to court and Judge Kim said, Mr. Wong, you decide what transcripts you want, you need. You order them, and then Mr. Turbin pays for them. In other words, the clerk, reporter sends me the bill. And I remember receiving that bill. I remember getting letters from Mr. Wong, why are you late in paying this bill? Maybe 30 days went by, and with my tail between my legs, went to my office manager, Ms. Chu, and I said, we need a check. We need a check to pay the court reporters for the transcripts. And we did pay the court reporters for the transcripts. And if we did not, Mr. Wong, I'm sure, would have filed a motion to haul me to court and ask for sanctions. We paid for what we had to pay. Having said that, I think it's also important to mention, which of you mentioned this, we had to pay a good deal of money for James Hahn's testimony. And James Hahn, the defendant, gave very, very cogent testimony about the pain and suffering Gregory Conahelli was suffered at the scene of the accident. Mr. Hahn was the first person there. You know, he was concerned about Mr. Conahelli's condition, happy that an ambulance came. He mentioned at the scene that not only did he see him hit the ground with his face, land first, face first on the ground, but that also at the scene he was complaining of a very sore throat. And that also Mr. Hahn testified that Gregory was conscious at the scene. So this is a transcript that Mr. Wong ordered, and I dutifully pay for. We were not ordered to pay for the transcript of all the testimony. We were ordered to pay for the transcripts that Mr. Wong believed were relevant transcripts to the issue of appeal, and Mr. Wong was to order them. We were to pay for them, and that's what happened. But again, I don't believe, now Dunbar and Walsh, they don't specifically talk about what transcripts are needed for an issue of zero general damages award. But if you read what the ICA has to say, it seems pretty clear that they're not requiring any transcripts. They are making the point that a zero general damages award is inconsistent with a special damages award, and the same testimony that is utilized to have a special damages award rendered is also the testimony that's utilized for a general damages award. And I think Justices McKenna and Justices Acoba point that they make to Mr. Wong is quite cogent. He conceded when the jury came back, he conceded immediately that it was an inconsistent verdict. We more or less verbally stipulated to that. The judge, Judge Kim, was quite concerned about it and sent the jury back. And then I believe Justice Acoba mentioned that the jury's final question with respect, jury has read the instructions and request the following clarification with respect to general damages for Gregory Conahelli Jr. What is the range the law allows? What is the minimum amount required under the law? And that's what they were asking the judge. What's the least we can give? And the judge did not give them an answer, so they came back with $1. Clearly, that was their goal. That was their intention, to give the least they possibly could and circumvent the law, not award a fair amount in general damages. Again, the transcripts that we were most concerned about getting to the ICA were the transcripts pertaining to this final denouement of this trial, this very disturbing denouement of the trial where it was clear the jury did not want to award general damages. And those were the transcripts we ordered first and got over, and we paid for those. We paid for those, and we got them to the ICA. And Mr. Wong wasn't what he was concerned about. He wanted to get the transcripts of some of the witnesses, which we paid for. So what we are appealing is, I know the court knows what we appealed, what we asked for in cert. It was granted, of course, but that the ICA just did not, the ICA was totally silent on whether the $1 in nominal general damages is the same or equally inconsistent as $0. And I think it's clear, and I know that this court is aware that that's the decision that needs to be made here. Exceptions, I think the court's point that there are some exceptions, such as the plaintiff being unconscious and dying, and this certainly is not the question here, and the question about whether special damages are way too high and include the general damages. So I think my time is up, so I'd better stop. Thank you very much for giving us this oral hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Turbin. Thank you, Mr. Wong. The court will take this matter under advisement.